Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from WETS FM and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Our topic today is, it's a strange word. A word you've probably heard before, but, well, maybe not. Have you heard the word eugenics? Not genetics, but eugenics. Does that mean anything to you? Well, if you're like me, as soon as you hear that word, as soon as you realize what's being discussed, you start seeing burning swastikas. You start seeing Nazi stormtroopers. You start seeing jackboots. You see, because eugenics is the study, the belief in breeding of human beings, selective breeding of human beings to produce what Friedrich Nietzsche called a Superman, or as the Germans called it, an Übermensch. And this was at the core of the Nazi theology, the ideology of the Nazi regime. And it was a very nasty idea. Did you know that the Nazis didn't come up with it on their own? Did you know that they had help from overseas? And specifically, did you know that much of that help came from right here in the U.S. of A.? Shocking, isn't it? We'll talk with author Edwin Black, who's written a book called War Against the Weak, in which he's documented the American experiment with eugenics, primarily in the early 20th century, but lasting a lot longer than you think and causing a lot more damage here than you realize. We'll also talk with Governor Beverly Perdue of North Carolina, who's spearheading an effort in her state to compensate victims of her state's eugenics program. Let's begin with Edwin Black. You are the author of a number of books and articles, including one that I think is probably quite appropriate for our topic today, War Against the Weak. Could you tell us a bit about your research into eugenics?
War Against the Weak chronicles the sorry chapter in American history in which the American establishment and elite attempted to establish a master race. It was to be white, blonde, blue-eyed, and to have dominion over the earth above all other peoples. And this occurred at the beginning of the 20th century, when the United States was in a torrent of economic and sociological dislocation. There were a lot of East Europeans coming in from the East. There were millions of Mexicans now in the United States and the Southwest as a result of the Mexican-American War, in which we took over half of Mexico. There were, of course, vast numbers of Chinese on the West Coast who had come in to build the railroads. The Negroes were off the plantation during the Reconstruction period, and the Indians were off the reservation. There was intermarriage, and there was economic dislocation from the transition of an agrarian society into a cosmopolitan urban and industrial society. And the power elite wanted to turn back the racial clock, if you will. And they wanted to get rid of all the people who had certain traits that they attributed to the ills of society.
Let me interrupt you if I may. Now, I've done a little bit of research into this, so I'm not completely taken by surprise by your statements, but I think there are probably some listeners who will be utterly shocked to think that this sort of thing happened in the United States. This sounds like the sort of thing that happened in Germany around that time.
They're going to be even more shocked in a couple of minutes.
Well, please continue.
Because then what they're going to find out is that we invented this process here, and we transferred it into Nazi Germany decades after it began in the United States. Let's get our timeline straight.
Please.
Adolf Hitler came to power in 1933, the Nuremberg Laws in 1935. World War II broke out with the Blitzkrieg on September 1st of 1939. The United States entered the war in December of 1941 after Pearl Harbor, and at about that time, the industrial killing of the Jews began, and the war was over in 1945. The period that I'm talking about involves the first 15 to 20 to 30 years of the 20th century. And at that time, the American eugenicists decided that they were going to turn back the racial clock and cure the ills of the United States along the principles of Mendel's principles of heredity, and where the striped pea is matched up with the clear pea, and out comes a series of peas that are either striped or clear. But no striped pea can contribute to a lineage that is not in some way striped. And so they were trying to get rid of bloodlines. And who did they want to get rid of? They wanted to get rid of the Jews, the blacks, the Asians, the Indians.
Who were these eugenicists? Who were some? Are there any names that we might recognize?
Well, you might recognize some. Alexander Graham Bell, who, of course, wanted to get rid of all the deaf people. The greatest judges, Oliver Wendell Holmes, the bankers, the elite, the legislators, the university presidents, the president of Stanford University, people like that. And they had the power, and they thought that social problems were a genetic disease, a genetic condition. So you were not born into prostitution. Prostitution was born into you. You were not born into poverty. Poverty was a genetic trait that you had, and you were not thrown into criminality. You were, quote, a born criminal. And they thought that the best way to get rid of all the people that they didn't like was through eugenic methodologies, which included public gas chambers. The first legislation for public gas chambers was entered into the Ohio state legislature in 1906.
I have to ask.
Marriage prohibion, which was legislated across the United States.
Hold on, before we get to marriage prohibition or other eugenics methods, the state of Ohio, did I hear you say, actually constructed gas chambers? Did they actually use them?
No, it was not successful. They entered the legislation in 1906, but it wasn't successful.
Okay, so they didn't actually.
They did not gas people in Ohio, but they did have organized euthanasia in other places. Such as Illinois, in Lincoln, Illinois, where runaways and juvenile delinquents and the impoverished and orphans were consciously fed tubercular milk from tubercular cows to get rid of them on the theory that if they had any eugenic strength, they would withstand a tuberculosis. So without being able to enforce the euthanasia on a legislative level, they went to marriage prohibition, which, as you know, it was a felony to intermarry until the 1960s, Loving versus Virginia, when that was finally overturned. There was marriage voiding in Virginia, which is where you're from. They had an entire bureau whose job it was to research the genealogy of people and void their marriages. That was run by a state official called Plecker. And there was confinement, concentration camps, or confinement camps, such as in Vineland, New Jersey, all over Virginia, North Carolina, Massachusetts, etc. They had pretty names like colonies for the feeble-minded and things of that nature. And there was forced surgical sterilization. Now, forced surgical sterilization was done to about 60,000 Americans in these first decades of the 20th century, pursuant to state laws in 27 states.
Now, what were the typical state laws used to justify this? These were supposedly feeble-minded people, or were they criminals?
Well, state laws don't justify.
Excuse me. What was the rationale that they cited, or what was the standard that they were attempting to impose before they would sterilize
somebody? The scientific standard across the United States, from Harvard to Stanford, was that the socially unfit, the eugenically unfit, should not continue their bloodlines. And if they were deemed to be feeble-minded or eugenically unfit and qualified for a termination of their bloodline, they would be sterilized. And some 60,000, and probably double that number if you consider federal programs with the Indians, mm-hmm. some 60,000 Americans, mainly women, in large part without their knowledge or without understanding, without true consent, were forcibly sterilized. And at all times, California had about a third to a half of all sterilizations. Now, you were asking about the legal basis for this,
mm-hmm.
And I know you're involved in the Constitution. And there was reluctance to enforce some of these laws, and they consequently had a collusive lawsuit in your home state of Virginia called, I'm sure you're familiar with it, Buck versus Bell.
Yeah, an infamous case with Oliver Wendell Holmes writing the majority opinion.
The infamous case, mm-hmm. where what they called white trash, a gal, Carrie Buck, in Lynchburg, Virginia, was subjected to a sterilization order, and the state of Virginia teamed up to collusively plan her her lawsuit against the state, her appeal, and ultimately a completely bogus case before the before the Supreme Court, with all sorts of scientific testimony and evidence from people who had never even met her or seen her. And it was Oliver Wendell Holmes who ruled in the famous case that you well know, three generations of imbeciles are enough. It is better to sterilize the mother of Carrie Buck herself and her daughter, than suffer to execute them for their criminality. And the precedent that he used was inoculation for syphilis, which therefore reduced these people to a kind of a bacterial human character, Untermenschen.
Right. German means subhuman.
That's right.
Right.
And it was after that case, the Carrie Buck case, that the floodgates were opened, and you had this massive amount of sterilization. Now, it was interesting that in your home state, the state of Virginia, I believe it was on March 24th of 1920, that the Eugenical Sterilization Act, and you could correct me on this, was passed. And it was just a few hours later that the Racial Integrity Act was also passed. So you see how these things worked hand in hand. They basically medicalized racism. Now, all of this would have been completely impossible, and this is the part your listeners need to to understand. All of this would have been completely possible were it not for vast amounts of corporate philanthropy.
So what
here I'm speaking about the Carnegie Institution, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Harriman Railroad fortune, who spent millions to establish a nerve center of eugenic research and implementation on Long Island at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratories, and also to establish this pseudoscience in the highest corridors of academia, Harvard, Stanford, Yale, University of Indiana, just across the board, you see these extraordinary departments of eugenics and chairman of the eugenics department, et cetera, et cetera.
And so you actually had academic departments at these universities called the departments of eugenics.
Of course.
That is just remarkable.
This was the science of the time. It was based on absolutely nothing, and I think most of your listeners believe that the terms imbecile, moron, and idiot are insults. But you, who's interviewing me, you may know that these were actually scientific terms. which were developed by the eugenics community to bogusly measure the IQ and to stigmatize those that they wanted to get rid of by asking fake questions and trick questions on the mental intelligence test. And, of course, this test actually evolved into the IQ test and the SAT test. It began as the alpha and beta test of the military.
Remarkable.
So they began to realize, that it was never enough to try to get rid of all the people here. Their goal was to get rid of the bottom tenth, 14 million people at a time. So they would slice off the bottom tenth, and then when we're done with that bottom tenth, they would slice off the bottom tenth of the remainder and keep taking off 10% of the population at a time, you know, about 10 to 14 million until no one was left except those who resembled themselves. They even wanted to get rid of the hillbillies, the Appalachians, that is, white guys with brown hair, because white guys with brown hair were deemed to be bastard or mongrel Caucasians.
Well, speaking as a white guy with brown hair, I have to take exception to that description.
But, yeah, I know you do.
And I also have to ask you, this sounds awfully Nazi-esque. I mean, there must have been a connection across the Atlantic then.
Yeah, so what they did was they then transferred this into Nazi Germany because the German ideal was, in fact, the ideal that they espoused in the United States from about 1903 to about the mid-20s. These eugenic academic and university textbooks were translated into German. And the the Carnegie Institution, the Rockefeller Foundation, spent millions of dollars to propagandize this stuff into Germany. It was read by Adolf Hitler while he was in prison, and he actually seized upon the entire philosophy. He praised American eugenics in Mein Kampf. He wrote fan mail to Margaret Sanger's colleagues. Margaret Sanger, of course, was a eugenicist who wanted to get rid of two-thirds of humanity using methods other than euthanasia. She wanted birth control. And Hitler wrote fan mail to her members of her board, like Lothrop Stoddard. And then Hitler medicalized his pre-existing National Socialism, sense of German superiority and anti-Semitism, to create his own quest for the master race, substituting the term Aryan for Nordic, which was the American blonde, white, blue-eyed ideal. And he then implemented this with a horrible, merciless military, and continuously throughout the realm of the Third Reich, it was the catchphrase of the Nazis from Hitler down to say National Socialism is just biology in action. In fact, the entire catchphrase of the Nazi realm, Rassenblut, which means race and blood, was, of course, invented by the president of Stanford University in 1901, 30 years before. That would be Jordan, who wrote his book, Blood of the Nation, and set forth these eugenic principles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're talking with author Edwin Black about the American eugenics program, a program that was both an inspiration and a source of information for the Nazis. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll talk some more with Edwin Black. Stay tuned. time for the quiz. It's time for Kelly. It's time for James Madison's Montpelier and all of the terribly difficult questions Kelly brings. How are you, Kelly?
I'm great, and it's time for a question on the Second Amendment.
The Second Amendment. Who do we have on the line?
Justin.
Justin, where are you from?
Richmond, Virginia.
Richmond, Virginia. Well, then you...
Now, have you visited James Madison's Montpelier?
I have not.
Justin.
It's not far from Richmond.
I know.
You need to go.
Make a trip.
You need to go. All right. Let's talk about the Second Amendment. Kelly, what's your question?
All right, Justin. The right to keep and bear arms under the Second Amendment has A, always protected gun ownership from restrictions by federal laws only.
Okay, that's choice A.
Mm-hmm. B, began as a protection from federal incursion on gun ownership, but was applied to state regulations in the United States versus Cruikshank decision in 1875. C, began as a protection from federal incursions on gun ownership, and it was not applied to state regulations until Donald versus City of Chicago in 2010. Or D, has always protected gun ownership from restrictions by both federal and state laws.
Okay. Very interesting. That's a tough question. Why don't we go through them one by one?
This is a tough one.
Okay. And then it's very tough.
Yeah, that's all right. We'll do it. So the Second Amendment, it does make sense.
No, but if you've been paying attention...
We'll do it. That's no problem. Okay, so go ahead and let's go through them one by one, please.
All right. The right to keep and bear arms under the Second Amendment has always protected gun ownership from restrictions by federal laws only.
What do you think about A? The Second Amendment basically protects us against the feds, and that's it. So if the states want to regulate our guns, the states can do it.
Well, I have a problem with this one because of some D.C. law I think I heard of a while ago restricting gun rights, and I don't know how that will play in.
Okay. Well, at this point, the question is, can the feds restrict our gun rights? Can the states restrict our gun rights while the feds can't? Or does the same Second Amendment principle apply to both the federal government and the state governments?
I think it applies to both the federal and state government.
Okay, so then what does that mean for A?
That it may be true.
You think A might be a good one. Okay, well, let's put a tick mark next to A then. Okay, then B.
B, began as a protection from federal incursions on gun ownership, but was applied to state regulations in the United States versus Cruikshank decision in 1875.
Okay, so as of 1875, the states also had to protect our Second Amendment rights. What do you think about that one?
I think that I still think it would have always been protected under federal rights.
Okay, but not state rights.
No.
Well, we're not stating that very well. The Second Amendment protects us against the federal government restricting our gun ownership, or does it protect us against state governments restricting our gun ownership?
It protects against both.
Okay, and answer choice B says that it started protecting against both the state and the federal government restricting our gun rights as of what,
1875.
1875. So did that happen in 1875 in the Cruikshank case?
No, I think it happened earlier. I think it always has protected our...
Oh, okay.
I think it's always been under both the federal and state.
All right. And what about answer choice C, Kelly?
C, began as a protection from federal incursions on gun ownership, and it was not applied to state regulations until McDonald versus City of Chicago in 2010.
Oh, okay, so now
it's
answer choice C
recent.
Is saying it's only very recently the Second Amendment has been applied against state governments restricting our gun ownership rights.
No, I definitely don't agree with that one.
You definitely don't agree with C? Okay, and then what's D?
D has always protected gun ownership from restrictions by both federal and state laws.
That seems to be your position, isn't it?
It is.
Okay, so you like answer choice D.
I do.
Do you like it so much to say that it's your final answer?
I do. Final answer.
Final answer. Kelly?
All right. Well, unfortunately, the question you said absolutely not is absolutely the right answer.
Well, Justin, we have to say we admire the strength of your convictions.
Yes.
Well,
it's just that they're not right. Exactly. The McDonald case was actually a landmark case. In fact, here's a brief history.
Second Amendment has never really had much force in effect throughout most of American history until very recently in 2008. The Supreme Court of the United States said that it protected an individual right to keep and bear arms, and that was the famous Heller case, Heller versus District of Columbia, but that was only relevant to the federal government restricting gun ownership. And then in 2 years later, in the McDonald versus Chicago case, Supreme Court said, no, it also protects gun ownership against state regulation. And so that McDonald case is very recent, and it's also extraordinarily important, along with the Heller case from 2008. But thanks
anyway. Well, I guess if I would have thought my answer out a little bit more, when we were talking about A, I said something about that D.C. case, and I had no idea what it was. I just heard about it in the news.
When I heard you say D.C. case, I was thinking, this guy knows Heller.
He's going to get it.
He's going to get it.
He's going to get it. Should we give him our booby prize?
Our booby option. Our booby option. Well, now that sounds really risque. I think I know what Kelly's trying to say.
Can you say booby prize on the air?
Sure you can. I know what you mean. What Kelly's saying is that she has another question. She gives people a second chance sometimes. Do you want to take the second chance question?
Sure.
Okay. If you lose a second chance, though, we have to wash our cars, right? Is that the...
Yeah.
The
that would be nice.
That would be good.
Maybe vacuum my car. That would be great.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah. Okay, what's the second chance question?
All right, Justin. What is the Third Amendment?
The Third Amendment.
And no cheating with the Constitution.
I'm not. I'm trying to think of it.
He's looking up to the left and the right. I can almost picture him.
I can almost see him. He's thinking,
I guess I should have studied a little bit more for this quiz. Because I unfortunately do not know that, and it pains me to say that, unfortunately.
Our listeners are probably screaming it out loud right now.
They're screaming it. It means no red coats in my house.
No quartering of troops.
It's Kelly's favorite amendment. Sorry it didn't work out for you today, Justin, but thanks for playing.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Me too.
Thanks,
all right.
Justin.
Bye.
You all have a nice day.
Mm-hmm.
Bye.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're talking about eugenics, the belief, the study of the idea that human beings can be improved through selective breeding. We're speaking with author Edwin Black, the author of War Against the Weak, and he's going to tell us about the connection between the Nazi program and a program in the United States.
This connection that you've been describing is not well known in the United States, and I'm sure
it's not well known, but that's why I wrote the book, War Against the Weak. It's important to understand that the people who put this into effect were the do-gooders, the liberals, the progressives. These are the people who wanted to improve society, to get rid of poverty, to get rid of all the ills in society by subtracting the people that they falsely believed were responsible for it due to some genetic character. And so this was not really done, if you will, by guys in white sheets burning crosses at midnight. This was done by guys in white lab coats and three-piece suits at the courthouse, in the halls of academia, in the medical laboratories. And this is what, this, of course, was pure genocide, which I'll get to in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But the Rockefeller Foundation was on such a bent to support Hitler's eugenics that after Hitler came to power in 1933, they began to pour millions of dollars to finance these pseudoscientific journals and conferences and congresses and fellowships and institutions, Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes, various portions of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes, and Hitler's greatest Nazis, including Otmar von Verschoor, who was the top Nazi doctor who wanted to get rid of all the Jews, who wanted to murder them, mass murder them. Rockefeller consciously supported that program of his research. And the greatest, the salient aspect of that research by Otmar Verschoor that the Rockefeller Foundation was financing was the twin project.
Mm-hmm.
And eugenicists believed that with twins they could discover the secrets of the mass production of the master race and the mass subtraction of the master race. Well, Verschoor had an assistant whose name was Josef Mengele. And Josef Mengele went into Auschwitz to continue the program of twin research that his boss, Otmar Vishor, had started, the Rockefeller fellow Otmar Vishor, and even though these horrible experiments were undertaken where a brown eye was infected and injected, and a blue eye was, and poor hapless victims had their veins sewed together, live autopsies. These all resulted in weekly clinical reports, which were motorcycled in the heat of war to his boss, Otmar Vishor, as eugenics. And so the world stood by, and the world learned of this and thought, oh, my God, this is monster science. But all the eugenicists understood completely what the rationale would be, which was to create a better world by getting rid of everyone who did not resemble the stereotype.
That's absolutely astonishing, I think, probably for most of our listeners, that there would be
when
such
the
a storm.
Americans came to Germany, to Europe, and they went to the concentration camps, they saw the implementation of American eugenics, they said, oh, no, this is not what we had in mind. Because the Nazis implemented American statutes and science with extraordinary velocity and ferocity, and ultimately resulted in the mass murder of 35 million people, including some, the mass murder and ultimate killing of 35 million people, including the genocide of 6 million Jews. And this now gives us an insight to understand that World War II was more than a war of economic plunder and territorial conquest, but it was a genetic war. It was a genetic war ignited by American philanthropic contributions, by American pseudoscience. At that time, once this was discovered, of course, you know the famous Nuremberg trials. They came up with the idea of informed consent after Mengele. You can't do a medical procedure without informing the person. Now, the Nazi doctors entered the California statutes, and Oliver Wendell Holmes' famous a decision in their own defense, and yet they hung.
I have to ask that. So the Nazis at Nuremberg actually used Buck versus Bell and Oliver Wendell Holmes' quotations in their defense at Nuremberg.
Yes, they actually entered the California statutes in their own defense, and they quoted, which you could hear the radio voice broadcast, or read it anywhere, the words of Oliver Wendell Holmes. I said, we were only doing what you guys did. Then, of course, the Americans said, this is horrible. We were not responsible. The word eugenics recedes from the scene and is replaced with a new word, same doctors, same laboratories, same Otmar Vishor, same funding, but now they changed the word eugenics to genetics. Same Cold Spring Harbor, same university chairs, same journals, they just changed the name to genetics. And that is the birth of modern genetics. It was actually eugenics with a name change. Now, you said, well, Mr. Black, we're not going to find any eugenicists in the United States after World War II because, of course, it was genocide. And what made it genocide? This is a radio show about the law, so you know that the Genocide Convention, Article 2, Sub D, restricting birth within a targeted group, is formally genocide. And who committed this genocide, according to the genocide international law? It is those who helped propagate it, those who helped implement it, those who helped publicize it. That's all set forth in the treaty that would make the Carnegie Institution, all the journal editors, the legislators, the doctors, just this entire complex of society. But while eugenics did recede from the American scene after World War II, it continued in many states, in several states, not many, at an accelerated level. One of them is North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And North Carolina, they continued the term, the Board of Eugenics. They still had eugenic journals. They still had a eugenic sterilization. Some 8,000 people were sterilized. There are 2,000 survivors today from that sterilization. And there is a move by the North Carolina legislature to compensate these victims. And it did not really stop until about the 1970s, when the last known sterilizations that I'm aware of, coercive sterilizations, were done. And the sterilization law itself that enabled all of this was only modified about a year ago under the leadership of Larry Womble, a North Carolina state legislator who has led the crusade for compensation. Of course, they're asking for compensation, some $20,000 per survivor, but that means nothing.
These people couldn't have children.
Because the real victims here are not the people who were sterilized.
Right. Yeah.
The real victims are the never born.
Right. The whole generations that are now missing. Now, just to talk about the law for just a moment, the Buck versus Bell, that infamous case with Oliver Wendell Holmes, was in 1927, and that was giving the constitutional sanction to eugenics. But just a few years later, in 1942, we had the case of Skinner versus Oklahoma, which is in all the constitutional law case books. And that case is widely perceived as having put an end to eugenic sterilization in the United States. But it's actually a relatively narrow holding. It invalidated an Oklahoma criminal statute which called for criminal sterilization of people who were of people convicted of crimes of so-called moral turpitude. But I think that people misread that case, because not only was it narrow, not only did it only overrule part of Buck versus Bell, but it was followed by decade after decade, apparently, in North Carolina and other states, of sterilizations of people, again, who were considered medically or somehow genetically unfit, not necessarily criminals.
Well, that is a correct interpretation analysis by you. It's not an interpretation analysis. It's an actual statement of fact.
Mm-hmm.
The first sterilization in the United States was done in Jeffersonville, Indiana, in a prison.
Mm-hmm.
By people who did not have control or consent. They were deprived of due process.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was 1906, but it could have been a year or two later, and or earlier. And so Skinner actually addressed, as you say, the Habitual Criminal Sterilization Act of Oklahoma.
Right.
And it overturned that as a punitive measure. But it didn't stop any of the concept of scientific eugenics.
Right, and that's the surprise for a lot of people. Even a lot of people of us who study constitutional law, we read Skinner and we were careless when we read it. We read it too broadly. We figured, well, that was the end of that. But it wasn't the end, was it?
It was barely the beginning of that.
Right, okay. Well, tell us about those last few decades then.
Well, first of all, I just want to backtrack
sure.
and mention that the famous Nuremberg Laws, I'm sure your sure. listeners know it, the Nuremberg Laws of 1935 defined who was a Jew, and it was a half a Jew and a quarter Jew and a 16th Jew. All these formulae were developed by the Carnegie Institution, Harry Laughlin of Missouri, who received in 1937, at the time of Skinner, an award from the Third Reich for his contribution to this eugenic science. But moving on to those subsequent decades, eugenics continued in the United States after World War II. I remember it growing up in Illinois in the 1950s and 60s. They were still sterilizing dwarves or little people, giants, people deemed to be mentally insufficient. And of course, it continued rampantly in the 60s and 70s in certain states, such as Virginia and North Carolina. But in most states, it began to recede tremendously. And then, of course, it was done in ways that are harder to track.
It's your weekly Constitutional, where we've been talking with author Edwin Black about Nazis,
eugenics, and the connection to the United States. So far, we've talked about the states who've had eugenics programs. After the break, we'll come back and talk about the federal government's eugenics program. Stay tuned. So, Kelly Carmichael, what's happening this week at James Madison's Montpelier?
Well, it's actually really exciting. We just furnished James Madison's room where he spent his final months of his life at Montpelier.
Is that his bedroom? Or
it's actually not his bedroom. He used to be up on the second floor, but if you recall, he had rheumatoid arthritis and was very crippled in his last few years. So we furnished the room that is right off of the dining room, and Mr. Madison always loved to have so many guests at the house. So
he can
continue to be in his bed and enjoy and talk to his dinner guests, but you know he couldn't join
John Jean showed me that room.
Yeah.
When we were on the tour, John showed me that room, and it actually opens off from the dining room.
Exactly.
So he could sit there, and they could open the door, and he could be talking to the people sitting at the table.
Yeah, and we've just added all sorts of different maps, and we've wallpapered the room in this really great green flock pattern. So it's a...
That's going to be a major change, because when I was there, it was really bare. The walls were bare and the floor was bare. So that, and in fact, I think there was even some exposed, I think, what did John call it? He had a word for it where you can actually see where the plaster was.
Absolutely.
And so now it's is it pretty much finished?
Yeah, no, it's we have furniture from Madison's time, including chairs and his bed and maps and a 1786 letter from Madison to Jefferson where he was stating his interests in maps and history of camels and elephants and wolves and tigers and stuff like that. So it's pretty nice to bring Madison back.
Now, was that the actual room where Madison died?
That is the actual room where he died.
Now, that is an exciting story, but sadly, we don't have time for it this week. But in the very near future, you can tell me, or maybe we can go back to that room. We can talk about Madison's last days. Anything else going on this week?
That is it. Come visit us, Montpelier.org.
Montpelier.org. We're going to go. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're going to hear a little bit more from author Edwin Black, who's going to tell us about the federal government's eugenics program.
I've told you about 27 states, and I've told you about some 60,000 Americans who were coercively sterilized. What I haven't told you about is the federal sterilizations. Remember, eugenics was a vast complex of local, state, and county statutes, laws, and regulations that constituted a national campaign that became enshrined as the law of the land by Oliver Wendell Holmes and the Supreme Court. But the federal government actually did its own eugenical sterilizations at the Bureau of Indian Affairs, through the Housing and Urban Development, where in those days they had, you might remember, NOR plants. Do you remember NOR plants?
Yeah, NOR plants, the permanent or semi-permanent contraceptives that are put under the skin, right?
Right. They said they would go into Chicago and other places into welfare, they would tell the women on welfare, if you want your check, you got to get a NOR plant. Which effectively caused sterilization. So I think it's important to put things into perspective. You know, they're still doing this type of eugenic activity. Just in recent days, I find that in India, they're trying to get rid of the lower castes by offering them TVs and portable radios and refrigerators and blenders, and in one case a lottery to see who can get a car. So
what, these are incentives for contraception or sterilization? Or
sterilization, not contraception. It's about the elimination of bloodlines. It's not just medical abuse. It's not just social neglect. It is the elimination of bloodlines. is genocide.
It's your weekly Constitutional, where we've just finished talking to author Edwin Black about the strange and disturbing subject of eugenics in the United States and elsewhere. Now let's have a moment with our Madison Minute.
In contrast to some other colonies, Virginia was not very tolerant of religious freedom prior to the American Revolution. In 1774, James Madison wrote to a college friend that he longed once again to breathe the free air of Pennsylvania. He complained that in Virginia, the diabolical hell-conceived principle of persecution rages among many lawmakers and clergy. Madison soon helped to change that. As the country moved toward revolution, George Mason's preliminary draft for Virginia's Declaration of Rights provided that the exercise of religion should receive the fullest toleration. That language did not go far enough for Madison. He proposed what would become a new standard for freedom of conscience. That religion, or the duty which we owe to our Creator, and the manner of discharging it, can be directed only by reason and conviction, not by force or violence, and therefore all men are equally entitled to the free exercise of religion according to the dictates of conscience, and that it is the mutual duty of all to practice Christian forbearance, love, and charity toward each other. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blalock.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we've been talking about eugenics. Most of our discussion has been historical, but these problems have not gone away. What do we do with such a legacy? How do we treat the victims of the forced sterilization programs of many states? Well, in one state, they're trying to come up with a solution, and that solution is being led by the state's governor, Beverly Perdue. I had the great privilege of speaking with Governor Perdue recently, and here's our interview. We apologize for the sound quality. Governor Perdue's a very busy woman, as you might guess, and she had to do the interview on her cell phone.
You know, several years ago, I had a small group of people from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Forsyth County, and two lawmakers, Earlene Farman and Larry Womble, come to me and tell me the real story that I had not heard of eugenics and what was done to many people across our state in terms of reproductive rights, in terms of their own civil rights. And it was a story that I found deeply troubling and sorrowful, and I couldn't believe it happened in North Carolina. And the more I learned about it, the more I heard the individual stories of the folks, the victims, if you will. I joined with the leadership of the Winston-Salem community in understanding clearly that there would never be any kind of money to enough money to repay. You couldn't repay people for the loss. I mean, these folks were sterilized, purely and simply. And they were sterilized based on advice from people, in many instances, doctors or social workers or leaders in a community that should have been based on the facts, but was, in effect, unfactual. And the people were encouraged or told to get sterilization for all kinds of wrong reasons. And they were victims. We never could repay them financially for what was done to them, but we had to take a couple of steps. Under the prior administration, North Carolina as a state issued a real intense resolution of sorrow and regret that such a thing as eugenics happened in this great state. And then as we assembled, I assembled a eugenics task force that's been very powerful for the last 3 years, trying to help identify folks who were sterilized, who were the victims. We have come together, and finally, I'm submitting to the legislature and including in my budget a call for not just the apology, but for a financial remuneration of some small way to compensate or to at least acknowledge financially the damage that was done to individual rights in the state. I'm also calling on the General Assembly, and my budget do the same thing, and this is as important as the money to me or the apology, for the development and construction of a permanent exhibit in North Carolina's Museum of History, as well as a traveling exhibit that can go to the public schools across our state and to many communities that will forever remind people of what can happen to a few when those in power decide to impose their will upon others. And I think this is very important. I don't beg to compare it to anything as critically important as the Holocaust museums across the country and around the world, but it is an evil that was done to a very small minority of people with very few rights in our state. And I don't want anybody to ever forget it could happen to the next generation
Governor, I think the comparison is quite appropriate. It might have happened on a smaller scale in North Carolina, but when I hear about eugenics and forced sterilization, the first word that comes to my mind is Nazis.
I have tried because, the magnitude of the numbers and the severity of the action are not at all comparable in terms of gross insult and the length of time. But for this small number of people, though their lives were not taken, and though their tangible property was not taken, their personal property, their personal health, their bodies were invaded by folks who should have known better and who, through misinformation, convinced, to some degree, these poor folks to make decisions that would irrevocably change the outcomes of their lives.
Well, how many such victims were there in North Carolina? How many have you been able to identify so far?
We haven't done very well at identifying very many. I'm putting enough money in the budget to pay, I hope, for as many as 1,000. None of us anticipate that many folks will come forward. You know, the reality is this is real personal. I went to one of the hearings myself, and I don't know if you've seen any of the tape or read any of the testimony, but that morning was one of the most powerful mornings I've ever been part of. There was one woman who got up and testified that her doctor had actually told her that this procedure was for the good of her family and that it was a temporary procedure. It could be reversed anytime she so chose, but would help her focus on helping her one or two children that she had get the best of life until she was ready to have another child. So all that was just a lie. And then another man, a non-African-American man, came up and talked about what had happened to him. And he felt like it was simply a pointed trigger at him because he was poor and white and lived in a really kind of bad area and that they didn't want his kind to have children. And so that in itself is horrific in my mind. So I tend to agree. The damage done to these people was as wrong as any damage ever done to anybody in the history of the world.
I am so sorry to hear about all of that. And how in the world did this come about in North Carolina or anywhere? Have you been able to figure out what possible rationale people could have had for this?
Nobody knows. Again, there are a lot of people who have just innate prejudices. We know that. There's an article in one of today's papers about the continues reemergence of prejudice in many people across the country and around the world. And whether it's racial or sexual or religious, those rights have got to be really fought for. And so this small group of people, for whatever reason, in many parts of my state, not just in the West Salem area, were triggered as being, from my perspective, someone who wasn't worthy of carrying on the civilization. And therefore, they needed to be neutered. And I find that reprehensible. I find it unpatriotic, un-American.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're talking to Governor Beverly Perdue of the great state of North Carolina, who is leading her state's efforts to compensate victims of the state's eugenics program, including forced sterilization.
Elaine Riddick was just 13 when a neighbor raped her. Then she endured what she refers to as her second rape.
I had to have a child at the age of 14, and when I had my son, they went in to me at the same time they gave me a cesarean birth and took my child, and when they did that, they sterilized me. What do you think I'm worth? What do you think I'm worth?
State officials declared Riddick feeble-minded and unfit to have children.
Reasons is because I was poor. And I am black. I believe that with all of my heart.
Based on the pseudoscience of eugenics, more than 30 states passed laws allowing for the forced sterilization of so-called defectives. The goal was to rid society of certain undesirable traits.
Some of those traits that they named were epilepsy, feeble-mindedness, promiscuity, criminal mentalities.
Researchers believe that as many as 100,000 Americans were victimized. By the time North Carolina ended its own eugenics program in 1974, it had taken away the reproductive rights of 7,600 people. Most, like Riddick, were poor. She drove from her adopted home in Georgia to testify before a North Carolina task force considering compensation for sterilization victims.
There's nothing that the state of North Carolina can do to justify what they did to me, what they did to these other victims.
It's your weekly Constitutional, where we're talking about the very disturbing subject of forced sterilization as part of state eugenics programs. Let's talk some more with Governor Beverly Perdue of North Carolina, who is heading her state's efforts to compensate victims of that program. Well, how long did this go on in North Carolina?
I think for more than a decade, and it's not just North Carolina, lest you think it's of the South.
Right.
It's many states around the country, and we are the leading state in America, in fact, the only state, to begin this very public walk of apology and of a remuneration of the victims, and then finally of this traveling and permanent exhibit to not hide from the past or try to bury the past, but to let folks know that the past can become the future if we don't all stay aware.
Mm-hmm. That's obviously a very tough step to take for any governor, any government to take, to acknowledge wrongdoing in the past. Did you encounter any resistance to your efforts to in this direction?
Well, I don't know what kind of resistance I'm going to have. I've been really grateful that the General Assembly, that's the legislature of our state, appears to be agreeing with me on the whole concept of some kind of financial settlement with folks who were victims. And again, let me reiterate, it's not enough money. There will never be enough money to pay somebody back for what was done to them. And this is just, in fact, a token, a symbol, if you will. I believe they're going to do that. I heard some rumblings yesterday that there was not equal enthusiasm for the mobile and permanent history exhibit. And I will get in the trenches next week and work on making sure they hear the reasoning behind this request, and I believe when they're fully informed that they will encourage and walk with me through this ability to stand up a different perspective on something that was heinous and how we in North Carolina react to it.
Well, Governor, we wish you the very best of luck with your efforts and hope that when you do succeed in establishing this this exhibit, that you'll let us know, because we want to come down and visit and we want to definitely feature it in our show as well. This is extremely important stuff you're doing.
Well, that's the best you can do in, as far after the event as it happened. At the end of the day, this generation of victims will soon pass on, and that's why the legacy of the exhibit is so important. So I'm grateful that you and your listeners can think about this and can be vigilant about other kinds of insults like this to some other American or some other group that is either deliberately or unwilling to have.
Thank you, Governor. We appreciate your time.
Thanks.
And that's our show. The strange and disturbing subject with strange constitutional implications. Eugenics. Eugenics and forced sterilization in the United States and abroad. I'd like to thank very much Governor Beverly Perdue of the great state of North Carolina. I'd also like to thank author Edwin Black, author of the book War Against the Weak. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.